Quarter to Three Movie Podcast. I am here with Christian Malinsky.
I prefer to be called Francois.
Okay, we can arrange that. We also have spoiler. Here with this week's tagline, Kelly Wand.
We rub lotion on my exposed parts. Wait, no, Saw's not a horror movie. No, wait, Poor Man's Ben Lyons. Wait, it is youth that's discovered love as a weapon.
That was four taglines. Those were all good. Send in your votes for which tagline we should officially designate to P.O. Box 1742, Peoria, Illinois, 91746 for this week's contest.
What just happened?
And, you always won a prize on these podcasts, and Tom just offered one.
That's right. The winner will
you
get...
You win Tom's zip code.
And the winner will get Kelly Wand as a personal manservant for a week. So there we go.
Treating up from podcasting. Team writing.
This week, we are going to spoil for you Youth in Revolt. If you have not seen it, now would be a good time to fast forward to our 3x3. If you have seen it, stick around, because we're going to talk about it. So first of all, show of hands, Youth in Revolt, based on a novel, which I'm sure Kelly has read and will tell us
amazing
about.
Amazing novel. Amazing novel.
But directed by Miguel Arteta. So show of hands, who here has seen Star Maps? Okay, that's what I thought. Do you guys...
Are you talking to the listeners or us? I never know.
I don't know of anyone who has seen Star Maps. You guys haven't seen it, obviously, right?
I don't think we have listeners, A. And B, no. What year was it?
19...
Oh, then no.
It was Miguel Arteta's first movie, and then he did a couple which some of us probably have seen, but I just remember it's sort of a gap in my Miguel Arteta cultural knowledge, Star Maps.
Well, you can't do him and Bergman at the same time.
Right.
Gotcha.
Right. That's good. Now, of course, Chuck and Buck and The Good Girl, I think some of us have seen. Kelly Wand, you strike me as the kind of guy who has seen Chuck and Buck. Is that correct?
Is that about the serial killer?
Not per se.
What am I thinking of?
It's about a guy whose creepiness factor is right up there with serial killers.
Oh, then I should see it. So I identify with those characters.
It's another gay movie, sort of. It's about these childhood friends who catch up with each other after many years, and one of them is kind of gay for the other one, and it's really weird and creepy, and he stalks him, and he basically blackmail or bribes him into sex, which also is a feature of Miguel Arteta's Good Girl, in which Jennifer Aniston is bribed into sex.
I thought that was The Good Wife.
What is that? That's Rachel...
The Good Mom is Diane Keaton and Leonard Nimoy is directing.
The Good Wife is a television show, isn't it?
That's the Thornbirds. You're thinking.
No, you're right. I'm an idiot.
So that's enough background for Youth in Revolt, I take it. there is no non-consensual sex in Youth in Revolt, though. I can say he has broken his tradition with his last two movies. Of featuring some
That's
sort of
what's
creepy,
missing from it.
But it has, in lieu of non-consensual sex, a sort of an icky instance of drugging someone.
And just like many
characters. Did you say an icky instance of drugging someone?
You know what? You're right. I was thinking specifically. Kind of... It's funny when you drug your Christian parents.
It's freaking pervasive in this film.
But when you try to drug the woman that you're trying to win over, that's a little weird. If your parents are Mary Kay Place and Emmett Walsh and they're just Christian caricatures, it's okay to give them mushrooms because that's wacky. That's like sitcom territory, so it's okay, right?
Is that your review for this film?
let's put some cards on the table. I'll go first. I really didn't care for it. I wanted to. I desperately wanted to. At times, I tried harder than other times. But overall, I did not care for Youth in Revolt. Now, let's go around the table. Christian Malinsky, how did you feel about Youth in Revolt?
I give it two middle fingers up.
Wow, you're mad at it.
I hated it.
Hang on to that.
And I wanted to like it, and I hated it.
Good. Use that anger. We're going to come back to that. Kelly Wand.
I feel... unqualified to judge it because the trailers ruined the movie for me, so now I can't tell whether I would have liked it or not because they gave away 98% of the payoffs.
Okay, well, that's what you get for watching trailers.
But I think I liked it more than you guys, but I thought it lost its bite towards the end, and I kind of wish it had only been like the first act of a much.
Now, before we go into the movie, I was kind of kidding before, but actually, Kelly Wand, have you read the novel that
no.
it's based on? Okay.
I know he goes to India to escape the police at one point, which is the level of wackiness I would have wanted.
Okay. So Dingus, let's hear a little bit about why did you flip this movie off? Because when you and I saw The Reader, I think you only flipped it one bird. So this movie, you flipped two birds after having seen it. What made you mad?
Well, now that you say that, I don't think it's fair to put it in the same category as The Reader, because I think The Reader is reprehensibly bad.
Okay.
I think this is just bad as a matter of taste and a matter of how it offends movies that I like that are good examples of the movies that this is trying to ape or the director this is trying to ape.
Now,
but The Reader is bad because it's just I don't understand what anybody likes about that movie. It's horrid. It's horrid.
Okay.
This movie I just hated because it was completely without any moments of authenticity, and I felt embarrassed for the actors over and over again.
No.
Right. I didn't feel that
you
way.
You didn't feel that
Sorry.
Way. You didn't.
My mistake.
You loved it.
Dingus, can I submit something that I'm curious if you would agree with this, because this is one of the things I was thinking as I watched it. I think that Youth in Revolt thought it was a lot like Rushmore.
I think
yeah,
you're right.
That's a good okay. point.
Like, and if I loved Rushmore as much as I know you do, I would probably want to flip it a couple of birds as well. Yeah. So Kelly Wand, to hear the other side of the spectrum here, you say you didn't dislike it as much as we did, presuming you did like
it. I thought it was
trying. Okay.
And there were some good lines in and of themselves.
Okay.
Which I think tricks me, because I even found I wound up, like I said, like not hating Sherlock Holmes till kind of later in the movie than you guys did. Because I'd hear one good line every once in a while, go, okay, blip. I'm sitting all right. But then, I don't know, by the end of Youth in Revolt, I felt revolted.
Well, here's what, and this touches a bit, I think, on where both of you are coming from. I just thought it was so uneven. I mean, there were some good lines, and there were
but
some really...
a lot of comedies are. Most comedies are take the good and the bad. Silent movie's really uneven. Are you hating on Silent Movie?
I don't know what Silent Movie is, but I think that part of the problem is that there were, at times it was bad, at times it was good. There were things in it that I really admired. It was, like you said, Kelly Wand, trying some things. I wished it had pushed certain angles farther. I wished it wasn't so tone deaf at certain things that didn't work. And it just really felt amateurish and like there was no one there who really had a sense for what they were trying to do or what kind of tone it was trying to capture.
It was as if the Napoleon Dynamite guys tried to make a David Russell movie.
Yep. Okay. I would go with that. And I would throw in, they obviously were, as we said with Rushmore, obviously enamored with some Wes Anderson tone.
Well, they were trying to be darker than Wes Anderson. So I thought.
Yep. I don't think so. Can I ask before we go any farther or further, Tom, you start and then, maybe Kelly too. Tell me exactly what you admired about it, because you both have said that it was trying for something. And Tom, you said you admired parts of it.
Mm-hmm.
There were lines I liked that I liked, but beyond that, I want to hear what you guys admired about it.
Sure. I want to see a movie that is Michael Cera in a latter day version of Play It Again, Sam. And at times, that's what this was trying, almost like, and it even seemed to get a little Fight Club darkish, you know, blowing up the flower shop in Berkeley. And, you know, they spent a little money on pyrotechnics there. That's,
he never gets a comeuppance, which I kind of like. Like, he drugs his girlfriend and then just talks his way out of it, being Michael Cera. Come on, that's good.
And that's part of the unevenness, I think. I mean, there were no moral consequences for some things that
That's a part of movie making that I miss, because back in the old days, comedies used to be more like this, and they used to not care about everything. I don't know, like the American Pie movies started introducing this idea that there had to be like a wholesome quality to teen comedies.
Okay, but I wasn't that concerned though with the lack of consequence. I mean, just to get back to Dingus's point, I mean, I think what I admired was this was watching Michael Cera, who is so stereotyped as a really nice bumbling guy, watching him really try. I mean, I enjoy watching him as an actor, and watching him try to play the bad boy when those contacts were obviously making his eyes so uncomfortable. I was just so tickled at that. But he was really giving it his best, and I'm not sure that he was quite up to it, but I enjoyed watching that. And whenever the movie left that conceit, I felt a little bit of wind went out of its sails.
Maybe it's because that alter ego was so cool and interesting in a nasty way, but everyone else in the movie was wacky too, so there wasn't like a normal foil, your Bruno.
Well, that's too. The movies, I mean, and this is what made me think of Rushmore. The movie was obviously in a sort of a hyper-realistic, youth-oriented, Rushmore-like world. And I don't feel that really, there were times they followed through with that. There were times they pulled back from it. I'm not sure how a Play It Again, Sam type conceit is supposed to fit in there. It was just overall erratic, but I loved that part of it. I really liked Jean Smart as his mother. I loved the girl, Portia Doubleday.
Yeah. And it was a tricky role.
It was. And now Kelly, I want you to talk in a minute, but first of all, I want to ask you guys, because this was like an epiphany I had in the middle of the movie. Do you guys know who Portia Doubleday is a dead ringer for?
It didn't
hit either of you?
Well, it hit the... This isn't. I don't think this is what you're going for, but there's a scene when she's up on the stairs talking down to quote unquote Carlotta that she really reminded me of Olivia Williams. But I don't think that's what you're going for.
No, if you look at her, like her face is a dead ringer for a young Veronica Cartwright. And once that clicked in my head, I just couldn't. I kept seeing it. And now Veronica Cartwright's mainly TV these days, but you guys know her from Aliens or Alien, the first Alien.
She's hotter than Veronica Cartwright.
No, well, Veronica Cartwright is far too gaunt. What are you
Well,
talking
Veronica
about?
Cartwright is also older. I mean, just seriously, look at pictures of the two of them. She's a young Veronica Cartwright, and that just, I was like, wow, that's that.
No, I can see Veronica Cartwright in my head from Alien, and she's waifish.
Well, I'm not talking about, like, I'm talking about the way her face looks, not necessarily how much baby fat or whatever she has. Okay, if you
I'm
guys didn't...
Gaunt you on this gong.
Okay, you're fired.
Crazy.
I'm gonna
you're
fire.
You're fired. I fire you before that.
I think I'm with Dingus on this.
Okay, you guys obviously don't. Whatever. You're both fired. I'm gonna do this podcast solo.
But one of them's like a sex bomb, and the other one's like the frail character who's always getting killed by the aliens.
All right, I'm gonna post a separate by birth side by side photo on the internet, and we'll have listeners vote.
And they win a Kelly Wan manservant.
Exactly for a week,
which is really valuable.
So those are the things that I liked. Those are the things that I admired, and I wished that they had pushed a little harder. So Kelly Wan, what were some of the things that that you liked about the movie?
I like movies with car crashes, mm-hmm. and explosions and fruit carts getting upended. And I liked his French character. It was funny. It was funny seeing Michael Cera do. That's the only way he could have gotten to be a bad boy character is if he was French. Right? He's with me.
It certainly helped.
It made me want to read the book, which I understand was self-published initially. And then it became like a cult classic. There's like seven of them, and he goes to Mexico and he knocks her up or something. Sounds very convoluted. So now I want to compare it.
Well, that explains parts of the movie then. I mean, the movie gets a little convoluted. I mean, it's definitely missing narrative focus, I think. There's a lot of back and forth.
It reminded me of Orange County. Remember that movie Orange County with Colin Hanks?
You know what I have?
Yeah. The Mike White film?
Yeah. It's just kind of chill. It wants you to like it, but it doesn't care too much. Mm-hmm. Did you like all the, I like the animation too, and a little stop motion.
No, mm-hmm. I thought that was sloppy and really indicative of how clumsy this film is.
Especially,
what'd you say, Kelly?
It was dumb, but in a cheerful, playful, dumb way.
Well, I'm sorry, if that's all you can come up with for what is supposed to be an incredible drug scene when he takes all of those mushrooms, if all you can come up with is that animation, F you. that was it? That's it? Some floating characters from the Joy of Sex knockoff book, and he pokes one in. That's it? That's all they came up with for his whole because the whole thing is these are really powerful. This is just – it was just so clumsy. All of these animation sequences were so clumsy.
I thought it was a Charlie Brown kind of animation, and he's like a Charlie Brown figure.
Well, he tries what is it, 3 or 4 different types of animation throughout the film, and I was really sort of rooting at the beginning, like, oh, this is interesting. Maybe we're going to go somewhere. And then when we do the driving animation, I'm still sort of holding on. And by the time we get to that animation for the mushroom scene, I'm just saying, is that all you came up with? That's all the imagination you have for this moment?
Did yes. you guys see Paper Heart by any chance?
Is that the Tatum O'Neill one? Or is that the Albert Pinney?
Paper Heart is, and I'm going to butcher her name. I'm not even going to attempt her name. It's a young comic and Michael Cera. And it's a romance. It's a far better, I think, Michael Cera movie. And it also has these animated interludes that work, I felt, perfectly. And they're folded much better into the movie. They fit the tone of the movie. They have that same rough-hewn look. And they're adorable. I mean, they were instrumental to Paper Heart winning me over. The animations here, like Dingus is saying, I just felt like they didn't really have any good ideas. So they, you know, he got one of his buddies who does stop motion or whatever that technique was. And it's like, here, do something with this road trip. Here's two people driving. Just give me what you can. It just felt completely extraneous. I didn't care for the animation.
Yeah, you're right. It's dumb.
No, you can like it. It's okay.
No. You know, I want to say, too, that I liked Michael Cera a lot in this film, and I was looking for him. I don't know. I think at the end of last podcast, Tom said something about, is Youth in Revolt going to tip our Michael Cera tolerance meter? Something like that. And I like him so much. I'm predisposed to like him, I think, because Juno meant so much to me, and I liked it so much more than everybody else on this podcast. And I root for him, and so I was excited to watch him do this. I was excited to watch him kind of stretch. I don't think he was honored. That might be the wrong word. I don't think the director really honored what he was trying to do, or maybe he wasn't capable of doing so. Because I think the director failed the actors in this film time and again.
Yeah.
And that's what bothered me most, is seeing actors. And what the only part that I got mad at Michael Cera is, and I don't know how old he is, so this might be unfair, is that I didn't feel like he stood up for himself when he was made to do things that were ridiculous and completely out of character, and things that not only would no real person do, but his character wouldn't do.
Like what, Dingus? Like what are some examples?
The specific moment I'm thinking of is when he's putting – this is – these types of things make me want to scream at the screen. When he's putting sunblock on her and he straddles her, and they have this whole ridiculous – oh, you get turned on quickly. Well, maybe – she says all this stuff about her vagina, and he's a virgin who has barely ever touched a girl, and she asks him to put sunblock on her, and he – straddles her and puts his dick on her ass.
Whoa.
They cut the dick out. He had a fake erection prop, but they cut it.
That's not
true. There's no way that character does that. And there's no way any actor who is at a point where he says, my character doesn't do this, would let that happen beyond saying, let's go for a cheap laugh. That moment made me just scream. That's ridiculous.
You're blaming Michael Cera for that?
No, I'm not blaming him, but it made me feel like, why didn't you stand up for yourself then? And made me wonder, what, like I just said, how old is this actor, and can he stand up for himself, or is he more like his characters, where he sort of feels like, I just want to please everybody? And I felt bad for him. I constantly felt embarrassed for him, and in that moment in particular, because there's no way – I mean, I understand that moment where you're touching a girl for the first time. Your skin is on her skin for the first time. What – teenage boy who's a virgin is going to throw his leg over her and ride her like she's a horse.
It's not that kind of movie, though. You're talking about reality. This is a supposed to be. It's supposed to be cartoonish.
No, no, it's not. It's not. It tries to make you think that by those animation sequences, but it tries to keep a toe in both sides of the pond, and it just fails. It doesn't make you think that we're in some sort of crazy land, but it doesn't make you think we're in reality either, and I just don't accept that.
There was a scene like that in Rushmore, wasn't there?
If I were doing 1, 2, 3, I'd push the button. But
there was a lot of there was not a scene like that. Like Rushmore, at least was consistent with its hyper real tone.
Oh, okay.
And it had some touching moments, and this was going to be like hyper real and wacky when it was convenient, and it wasn't going to be when it wasn't convenient. And I kind of agree with Dingus. I mean that part I didn't notice, but in retrospect, yes, if we're going to have a movie about a shy virginal character. That's a little odd that he straddles her at that moment. I agree.
Well, in the moment when she says to him, "Kiss me, you twit," after she's been so provocative, and they're face to face, and she said something like, you know, it gets better with practice, when she's talking about sex, and they're right there, and she says, "Kiss," and he won't even kiss her right then. So before that, he'll just put his body on top of hers. I mean, there are little moments like that, little character touches that I expect to be better. And they failed me here, and they accumulated, and they made me angry. Especially when I know, without a doubt, that they're going for a Wes Anderson vibe, and I can tell you the exact moment when I knew that.
When?
Do any of you other people on this podcast want to answer this question?
I knew. There you go. Yes.
What'd you say?
Claymation. At the beginning.
Okay. But there was a moment when I knew when it was locked in.
The trailer.
What's the specific moment you're thinking of?
The specific moment I'm thinking of is when Kelly Wand is correct about the moment, when they get to the trailer. There's the whole intro. You know, we've already had the titles and everything. They get to the trailer, and there's a title card. There's a card that says, based on the journals of Nick Twisp, or whatever that is. It's Youth in Revolt, based on the journals of Nick Twisp. And there's Michael Cera, Zach Galifianakis, and what's the name of the mother?
Jean Smart.
Standing there beside the car, and they're standing there in. It's obvious that they're trying to do a Wes Anderson tableau, and they do the little title card underneath based on the journals of da 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 da, and they're standing there, and he's trying so hard for a tableau, but he doesn't know how to frame it. And I knew at that moment, it's not just me, you know, based on the opening things of the music and the voiceover, you are really going for this, and you're not going to get it.
Dingus is very fastidious about his framing. Remember when he got mad at the weather in An Education? That one part.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I still have no idea what he was talking about.
I don't either. But that's like he notices stuff. I'm always listening to the dialogue.
And it makes him mad too.
Enraged. Yeah. He's so full of fire.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I get a little anal. I apologize.
I'm getting a little echo, by the way, from someone's computer. One of the things that made me angry was the waste of a really great cast. I mean, if you are going to have Zach Galifianakis, and if you're going to have Mary Kate Place and Jean Smart, and if you're going to have Fred Willard willing to take his clothes off, and if you're going to have Steve Buscemi, and if you're going to get M. Emmett Walsh, for Pete's sake,
give them
something to do other than smearing mashed potatoes on their face. Ugh. That was just wretched. Even Justin Long. Oh, good Lord. Those people can be good. Use them. Give them material. That's what made me mad.
Well, I get the sense they got a lot of cut. That, you know, there used to be more. It was darker at some point.
Oh, like trimmed down. But I can't imagine what. I mean, Emmett Walsh and Mary Kay Place as the Christian parents, those were such... There was nothing funny or... I mean, those could have just been some local hires from Vancouver or something. There was no reason... to get really good actors for that, because they didn't do anything with them. Those were such stereotypical throwaway parts. I mean, they were basically props.
It was terrible. When Emmett Walsh says "Vaya con Dios," I just thought, what the hell? Why are you here? And he does that whole.
She reminded me of that.
Sorry, he does that whole like he does this recitation of legal jargon, which reminds me of Henry. Danny Glover in Royal Tenenbaums doing the legal jargon in Lethal Weapon.
He does it again in there too when the guy goes up to the star.
Vaya con Dios, why are you here?
Right? Yeah.
I understand as an actor that you're getting a paycheck, and I have no problem with that. But why are you wasting him?
And why would they just randomly kill off Zach Galifianakis after, you know, three scenes or whatever?
Because they could only have him for those days.
Right.
Yeah. oh, and Ray Liotta? Good Lord.
Yeah, I'm wasted. Damn it.
Can I ask something else?
Sure, yeah. Take it away.
Help me out here. Help me understand something. Because I want to talk about an idea, a couple ideas that might have made this film better, or might have made that, because I think there's a kernel of an interesting idea for a film here. And you've definitely got a cast where you can make a great film. What were the rules about, and I'm kind of a stickler for this, but what were the rules about the doubling of Michael Cera's character? Can you
there were
help
none.
Me with that?
Yeah, there were none. That was one of the points where I realized, you know, we're really not going to explore this, are we? This is just going to be used in a couple of scenes. But yeah, there were no rules, and that would have made an interesting movie. That's why I wish, because if I'm not mistaken, Play It Again, Sam, you know, where Woody Allen envisions Humphrey Bogart helping him through these times where he's a nebbish. That seemed very specific about the rules, that Humphrey Bogart was invisible to him and would tell him to do things. But there was some confusion here where Michael Cera would be watching Francois say things, and then she would hear them from Francois's mouth, and then he would pitch in, and you know, who was driving the car when, and they were just really sloppy with that. They didn't really seem to appreciate the concept that they had. And I noticed, too, it's featured very heavily in the promos for the movie. I'd only seen internet website, like internet ads, banners and whatnot, and it's a picture of the two Michael Ceras, and I think she's in the middle. They really pushed that concept, and I wish they'd pushed it a little harder in the movie. I wish they'd explored it some more and played with that some. But yeah, I agree, Dingus. I didn't get a sense for the rules.
Well, they made it seem like he was just going to turn into that dude from the promos that I saw that ruined the movie for me. And then they're really stingy with that character.
Yeah.
And he's a great character. He's like he's got this Daffy Duck.
What's the Daffy Duck quality?
Just he's what he is. He's just the essence of.
Well, I loved how they can't hide Michael Cera's physicality. I mean, he's so adolescent and awkward, and it's adorable. And so even when he's in that getup, you know, with the mustache and the contacts obviously burning his eyes and trying to make the smoking look cool, it doesn't quite work, and it's still awkward and gangly, but it's just adorable. I loved seeing that, and I just wanted more of that stuff.
And they're trying to do this, like, 5 o'clock shadow.
Yeah. Like a makeup beard or something. Yeah.
That kid has to be 48 by now. Because Juno was what?
12 years ago. Yeah.
See, I didn't see Year One, so I'm less sick of him than most people. I think people turn on these, your Michael Ceras and your Seth Rogans. Like, this guy's in it.
Well, I'm not sick of him at all. I'm just trying to think of how you make this concept, of the two of them, how you make it into something that works for the story. And they never set any sense of rules, so I never feel comfortable with it.
Yeah.
Like Tom, you mentioned, I think, him talking and her hearing both of them. That was one of the things I liked that they could have played with. There's that scene where Michael Cera One is sitting on her bedside, and Francois is standing up, and they're talking her into bed,
right?
And she does this thing with her eyes where she shifts them, so that maybe she's hearing both of them, or maybe it's that thing where you see a lot of characters do when they're in intimate scenes where they're shifting their eyes from eye to eye, and it looks like when it's close up that the eyes are moving a whole lot. So that could have been really utilized, but given the failings in the rest of the film where you don't know, is Francois separate? Is the rule of the film that everything Francois does is just him, totally ruins it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because there's that moment in particular in the breakfast moment where it's only Francois.
Right. Exactly.
Talking to the mom and Ray Liotta. And they're not reacting to anything really other than a couple of rude things he says. He's smoking. He turns over the cereal bowl. He's just done all of these things where he's vandalized his mother's clothes, cut up her bras, thrown her jewelry away. There's no
fallout over that either. They never address it. She never mentions it. And just like Minister of Goats, if you want to get away with anything, you just give authority figures mushrooms. And afterwards they won't remember that or mention it or like feel hungover.
And when he's tearing up his mother, flushing her jewelry down the toilet and cutting her bras, and I thought that was terrible stuff. I mean, after what his mother's going through, I remember thinking, oh, these are dire actions because, you know, she's a sympathetic character. And now he's going to be a jerk to sympathetic characters. So this is a challenge. You know, that's a challenging thing to do in the movie. And at that point, I was like, wow, well, let's see where this goes. But like you're saying, Kelly, yeah, no consequence, and they just ignore it. I don't even think she ever realizes that this stuff.
No, what if there was a scene of her sobbing over it?
Right, right.
The toilet flooding and destroying the house or something.
But I think that's part of the problem of the movie is it doesn't know what kind of tone it wants to adopt, what kind of movie it wants to be. How much it wants to dismiss certain things as being funny, how dark certain things are supposed to be. I mean, and it also, I just get so, you know, after you see a movie like Bart Got a Room, it's a very similar movie from last year about a virgin, you know, it's a coming of age about a boy that same age as Michael Cera. And it's just so true to its own tone. It sets it early on, and it's got a great cast. And it's just strong writing, and it makes salient points, and it's touching, and to go from something like that to a confused mess like this that has such a great cast is really it's just disappointing to have to sit through it. Kelly, did you see Bart Got a Room?
No.
Okay.
I only see things like this because I have to talk about it for the podcast. And go, yeah, you're right. It sucks. I'm an idiot.
You know, when we get to the point in the film where he says, I have to, where she's told him, you have to be bad, Nick, you have to be really bad. And he says, I have to be bad for the woman I love. I'm not sure what the actual line is. I felt like that was the first line of the film. And that now the film has got, because up until that point, I'm wondering, what does Youth in Revolt mean? Why is it called this? And then he says, I have to be bad, and I can't remember the line for the woman I love. And I felt like the movie could have started there and feathered everything else in and been a really interesting film, but it never got anywhere. And I got really upset. And go ahead.
No, I'm agreeing with you. It takes a long time to get to that point, and that's, you know, that's like all of that is filler up to then, you know, get there quickly, hit your premise. And then flex it, you know, really, really push it. I just think what it comes down to is I don't think, having seen Chuck and Buck and The Good Girl, I don't think Miguel Arteta is a very good storyteller. Like, I'm not that fond of him as a director, I'm afraid. It's kind of terrible.
Well, maybe he just didn't have the light touch that this material needed.
Yeah, I mean, and that's obviously part of what he was going for. But, you know, Chuck and Buck is supposed to be fairly dark. And same with Good Girl. I mean, that's a comedy, but it's supposed to be fairly dark. I just don't think he has a good sense of tone. I mean, you know what?
Good Girl's the same plot, too. It's like she has to act up to get what she wants, to get the man she wants.
That sounds vaguely familiar. I just remember not hating Jennifer Aniston in that movie. That was kind of a revelation for me.
I am curious to read the book to find out if it's any good, and to find out if the characters go beyond this shorthand of teenagers who watch French films and Japanese films and listen to vinyl, and that's all there is about them.
He becomes a millionaire by inventing some kind of watch, I think I read.
In the books?
Okay. Yeah, the books. Then he loses his fortune, if that helps at all.
Well, Dingus, what you were saying, I that's something that drove me crazy in Juno, but I accepted it in Juno because Juno was so stylized, and Juno was obviously about Diablo Cody's youth transplanted to modern day. And I didn't get the sense. I think this was supposed to be a period piece, but I'm not sure. But this whole idea of, you know, kids, like you said, Dingus, kids listening to vinyl and liking who was the singer? Serge Gainsbourg. And what kind of kid, Michael Cera's age, is going to pick Tokyo Story? Like, although I guess he was just joking. Well, no, he wasn't, because it shows him getting La Strada at the video store.
So that's why his animation should have been better, because if he was that textured a dude,
I guess
his mushroom trip would have been way more interesting.
But that's the thing, is I don't. This is obviously an older. This is obviously. I guess it's a period piece. Like, is it? Because I'm thinking now, we don't see any modern cars, do we? Or do?
No, that's not true. It's not just a period piece, and there's reasons why it's not. And all of a sudden, I can't remember why, because I was on the lookout for that. It's not.
Do they have cell phones? Nobody has a cell phone, do they? Because that's the dead giveaway. I mean, if it's in the last 10 years, there's going to be cell phones. And
no,
I don't
because
think
I was really critical of them winding up at phone booths and him asking Carlotta for a quarter. Because those things make me want to punch a goat. But there were moments here that were very clear that it was a modern film. And I'm sorry, but I can't place it. But I assure you that there were moments here, because I kept thinking, is. Are we in sort of – because the film opens, for goodness sakes, with him reading – with him masturbating to a magazine and then getting on his computer. And either right. I'm thinking, what kid has
redundant.
A penthouse? Or if he's that obsessed with vintage stuff, why doesn't he have some vintage porn that he's masturbating to instead of a penthouse – who has magazines anymore? Then he gets on his computer. But there was something else that was a dead giveaway for it, and I'm sorry I can't remember it.
All right. Dingus, give us some of your favorite lines from the movie.
Why would you do that to me?
I don't remember that line. Is that Emmett Walsh to Justin Long? No. Okay, Kelly Wand, give me some of your favorite lines from the movie. Go.
My vagina's moist.
Yeah, well, you would go there.
Wait, was that a line, or were you just...
Yeah, I was just talking.
One, two, three, not only you and me, got 180 degrees, and I'm caught in between, counting. One, two, three, feet apart, and I'm free, getting down with three feet, everybody loves ocean.
It might have been too soon, but I'm ready to move on.
Already?
Is that okay with that? I don't know. Did we have more to say? I kind of am done with Youth and Revolt.
I could complain about it all night, but I can save it for another podcast.
Well, now people are mad. The podcast is too short.
We got plenty of material. So this week's 3x3. Dingus, what do you got for us?
This week's 3x3 is your favorite gas station scenes. Not just three scenes that took place in a gas station.
Oh,
your favorite gas station scenes. Go ahead, Kelly Wand.
And actually, no, Kelly doesn't start. I start because I'll be introducing the 3x3 later on. So my number three gas station scene, and this was a good topic, Dingus.
Yeah.
In a minute, I wanted to hear why you thought of it, but I think if I ask you that, you might ruin my pick here. So I'm going to go ahead and roll out the birds.
Good one.
I know, yeah. And I even rewatched it. I don't know a lot of Hitchcock, and it's when I see something like The Birds, and specifically that gas station sequence, that I'm like, I'm really missing out. That gas station sequence in The Birds is just phenomenal. And you can see in there the seeds for things that Spielberg and Sam Raimi and the Coen brothers are going to go on to do. It's a work of genius. So I want to talk about that scene for a little bit. We've all seen The Birds here, right?
Yeah, it's awesome. That's a great scene. It's a
yeah.
Classic.
I can't believe you've seen it.
It's one of the few Hitchcock movies I have seen. I mean, I think I've seen three of the maybe four. I've seen three. The one with Claude Rains and the nuclear stuff in the wine bottles, and Cary Grant is the CIA agent. Notorious? Is that Notorious?
That's Ingrid Bergman.
Yeah, yeah, and Cary Grant, and then she's married to Claude Rains, who's poisoning her,
because
he's a former Nazi. So I've seen that one, which I really liked, and I've, of course, seen North by Northwest. And Psycho. But The Birds, so I want to talk about this scene, because I just love it. I went back and I watched it, and I think it encapsulates why filmmakers want to make scenes in gas stations. Because, I mean, obviously, a gas station is literally on the verge of exploding. I mean, a gas station is, it's something so incredibly mundane that has underneath it the power to just erupt. I mean, that's the whole point of a gas station. So the thing that I forgot about The Birds is how long it takes to wind up. By the time you get to that scene, which is where the movie really takes off, you're over an hour into the movie.
Yeah.
Hitchcock.
There's no music at all during the scene, so it's like.
Oh my God! Wow, that's an excellent point, Kelly. Yeah, you're right. There isn't.
In the whole movie. It's all.
Yeah. So, there's no music in The Birds.
Uh huh.
Wow, that's amazing. That's amazing.
So we, in that scene, it's so weird to see a suspense scene without music cueing.
Yeah, yeah. Wow.
That's another great thing about it. It just feels like, because it's really quiet, because aren't you seeing it happen without any sound, even because she's in the phone booth?
Well, there's several sort of layers to it. What happens is she's been attacked by birds and with several children at the school.
She's in the diner.
And so she goes to a diner and she's calling her father saying, what happened? What should I do? And because she's talking on a phone in the diner, people around her start hearing and the townsfolk start offering, you know, they start getting involved in the conversation and want to know what's going on. And this old lady who knows all about birds comes up and starts, overhears it and starts explaining things. And Hitchcock creates out of this, a lot of exposition, but more importantly, he's ratcheting up the tension as the people in the diner are getting more and more edgy about what's happening and some of them not believing it. And there's a mother there who's freaked out because her children are getting scared. So the whole diner scene leading up to what's going on with the gas station is just a masterful bit of storytelling and filmmaking. But then what happens is they see out the window a bird attack a gas station attendant filling a car, and the gas station attendant falls over and collapses, and he drops the hose, and a line of gasoline spills away from the gas station. But the people who run to help the attendant, their backs are to the line of gasoline. And there's a great shot of the people in the diner seeing that, you know, the bird attacked the guy, and they watch people helping the attendant. And the gas goes down to where a guy's about to light a cigar. And the people in the diner know, you know, they see that the gas has trickled down to him, and they yell to the guy. The guy struck his match. They yell to the guy, don't light your cigar. And he can't hear them. So what happened is he knows, well, he can't hear what they're saying. He hears them, but he doesn't know what they're saying. So they have successfully averted him from lighting the cigar, but he's sitting there holding the lit match and he can't tell what they're saying.
Yeah.
And he's like, what? And then the match burns his finger and he pulls back and it drops in the gas and he blows up.
They kill him.
Exactly.
Distracting him.
Would have had and then, of course, the flames go up to the gas station. The gas station explodes. The birds attack en masse. That's when Tippi Hedren, you know, people rush out. Tippi Hedren takes refuge in the phone booth. And the beauty of that phone booth, and Hitchcock uses this so well, is it's sort of the opposite of watching the action inside of a snow globe. She's inside a little glass enclosure where she can see all around her this chaos erupting.
Yeah.
And the gas station explodes and the cars are burning. And there's even, and this feels so random, but because it's in Bodega Bay, this charming little community, when a horse pulling a cart of fruit comes running into the middle of the scene, you know, where does that come from? That has this very Sam Raimi feel to it. And then furthermore, the birds start crashing into the glass of the telephone booth and sort of cracking that fourth wall in a way. But it all begins with that gas station. I mean, it's the gas station that ignites that amazing sequence. So that, you know what? I'm going to change that to my number one. I just wanted to put that out there so you guys can scoop.
You are such a creep.
Maybe there's no music in it so you can hear the birds better. You can hear their cooing.
Well, that's another thing is the sound of those birds, it's not a real bird sound. I mean, they came up with this weird altered screech thing, and it's, I don't want to say iconic because you don't hear a lot of scary bird noises in movies, but it's a really distinct, cool bit of sound design. Is how do we take the noise that a bird makes and tweak it somehow to make it seem unnatural and scary? And it's brilliant. You know, the goofy compositing they do to when the birds are attacking, like all that looks terribly dated. But the sound design of the birds is amazing stuff.
Yeah. Well, it's also such a dark, creepy, weird movie. Like she goes nuts at the end, doesn't she? Isn't she catatonic? And you never find out what the birds thing is.
Or yep. There's no, that's the thing is that's the only real exposition you get is these ill-informed people in the diner offering their opinions. When Steven Spielberg did his War of the Worlds, there's a great, you know, there's no exposition there, but there's a very brief sequence where Tom Cruise talks to a woman in a news van and she offers what she's heard. And as a matter of fact,
she shows him the tape of them.
Right. She shows him the tape. And actually, that's the case, I think, a few times in the movie where people say what they've heard, but it's not verified. It's not exposition. And some of it is, is contradictory. I mean, you get this sense that you're in the middle of these terrible events and there's no reliable information about it. And The Birds is excellent with that. You know, nobody ever comes out and explains that it was radiation or solar flare or something.
What about The Happening when the hot dog dude explains that the plants to the biology teacher? He's like, what?
Yeah, yeah, wow, The Happening is the polar opposite of The Birds.
I should have just stopped after saying that.
So that's my number three, and thanks for letting me talk about that scene. I just watched it again today. And another thing too, color films in 1962, I don't know what it is, maybe it's Technicolor, or it just looks so...
saturated?
I guess rich. That's the word. Yeah, rich, saturated. I was just going to say colorful, but that's kind of redundant.
Well, and he's coming off Psycho, so he totally wanted to spice up his palette too.
No kidding, that was right after Psycho, which was in black and white. How about that?
Yeah.
Wow.
He wanted to prove he could make a movie as cheap as Psycho, and then all right, back to The Birds.
It's
the other way around. I may be an idiot.
Is The Birds like one of his best movies?
It's one of my favorites, but I don't know. It's kind of an experiment in a lot of ways, so you're sort of distracted. I mean, to me, like the fact that there's no music is one of the great things about it, but it's also something you know. It's sort of distracting from the story in a way.
Well, I'm like you said, Kelly. I mean, that's part of what makes that scene work so well is there's no score keeping pace with the action. It's just the action, and it's just the sound of the birds, and it's just this unfolding chaos. And you know, if you've got an orchestrated soundtrack, that's not part of actual chaos.
Did you read the Daphne du Maurier novella that inspired the Hitchcock movie?
I did not. I presume you did.
No.
Oh, okay. Well. I guess you can't help us there.
It's really good.
So you've heard. Okay. All right. Well, that's my number three. That's my third favorite gas station scene. Did either of you pick that, by the way? Because it seemed like a shoe-in.
No, but I should have. It seemed like a shoe-in.
Dingus, you didn't pick The Birds?
So thanks for listening to this week's Quarter 3 Movie Podcast.
Oh! Well,
no, I did not.
Oh, you didn't? That's okay.
No, but everything I picked now pales in comparison, so we might as well close the podcast now. Thank you, everybody, for listening.
I've still got a couple of good ones.
Manolo will be glad to hear that, or whoever that guy was.
Did you say granola?
Granola, yeah. Guy who hates us.
Hey, Tom, have you seen The Cove yet?
No, I have. I don't watch documentaries.
I don't watch sad movies about dolphins.
You won't watch Day of the Dolphins?
The Cove's about real dolphins getting jacked over by... never mind.
What made you think of The Cove? Is there a great gas station scene in that movie?
Yeah.
No, but something you said really triggered a reaction of mine, and I can't talk about it because you haven't seen it. So,
all right, I'll
We'll talk about it, okay. And you'll ask me, why the hell did you say that? Then I'll have to
luckily,
say, oh.
Tom's 3x3 topic's dolphin themed.
Kelly Wand, what is your third favorite? Dingus, you go last. Kelly Wand, what is your third favorite gas station scene?
My number three gas station scene is from a movie that I don't think is that great, but it's my favorite scene in it, and it always stays with me for some reason. It's Tom Savini's Night of the Living Dead remake.
Wow, I don't remember. That's with the redheaded chick from Babylon 5.
Yeah.
Don't remember a gas station scene. Tell me about it.
It's a really crappy movie, but it the whole movie, something I like about it, and it's a theme of the other ones before Romero jumped the shark with Diary of the Dead. But it's basically about people who can't work together all dying because they're stupider than the zombies because they can't cooperate. Mm-hmm. And the apotheosis of... I love character-based carnage, which I think is one reason I'm a Youth and Revolt apologist. and my Daffy Duck thing was, Daffy Duck was perpetually frustrated all the time, and Francois is as crafty as Daffy Duck, but he's unflappable and unfrustratable.
Okay, hold on, let me rewind. Okay.
So everyone who skipped ahead to the... Never mind.
Describe for us the gas station scene in Tom Savini's, is it Dawn of the Dead? Yeah, Dawn of the Dead remake.
Yeah, there's like a couple, or a brother and sister who are both dumb, like a couple of rednecks, and so they basically all have to, like, the black dude has to go distract the zombies. So,
wait a minute, Kelly Wand, this is a straight-up Night of the Living Dead remake, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because that's straight out of Night of the Living Dead.
But I don't remember it being like this in the first one.
Go ahead and describe it, because I'm pretty sure it is. Go ahead, because I
don't
wish
remember
now
the redneck brother sister people.
Yeah. Oh yeah, yeah. And it, and the redneck boy dies. You know, he gets killed at the gas pump.
In the remake. Tell me if this happens in the original, because I totally forget. In when they drive the truck to the gas pump, and then there's a lock on the pump.
Yep.
So he tries to shoot the lock and. It blows him up the truck, the gas pump.
Oh, that is
huge.
That is
laugh.
Amazing.
When I saw it, including from me, and I was just like, ugh. And then nothing else in the movie really matches that, because it's more of a subtle thing. Like,
oh, that is beautiful, Kelly Wand. I don't remember if that's how it happens in the original, but that is beautiful. You know what, Kelly? That is awesome. When you talk about character based carnage, when characters do stupid things to spectacular effect, that's great.
That's why I'm a burn after reading apologist.
Ah, good.
You loathe, but there's just people acting so self destructively and stupidly, and
I
love that stuff. And to me, it's just real. Like, just people are so dumb.
That's great. Okay, that's a good one, Kelly Wand. I like that.
And you handle the news because it's too much dumb, so I watch my fictional Burn After Readings and Night of the Living Dead. But that doesn't happen in the original one?
I don't remember if he shoots the lock off. I mean, they have to get the truck to the fuel
pump. They don't blow up a gas station in the first one, do they?
Well, no, he definitely burns to death. I don't know if they could, like, do an actual explosion, because, you know, it was George Romero and some buddies in Pennsylvania making the movie. So I don't think they could actually blow up a gas station, but I'm pretty sure that there's a mishap with the fuel pump and he ends up burning to death, if I'm not mistaken.
In the remake, I think he and the sister both get killed, because she's in the truck waiting for him, so he kills both of them. And blows up the truck, and then they're all just watching and going, oh.
That is spectacular.
It's like a Left 4 Dead 2.
It's like Dingus playing Left 4 Dead 2.
Yeah. Hey, wait a minute.
So, I don't want to oversell that movie, but that one 5-minute sequence is
good.
Excellent.
Very nice. Very nice.
It's hooray for Tom Savini and his 5 minutes of awesomeness.
Good. All right, Dingus, what's your number three?
My number three sucks.
My number two really sucks.
My number two really sucks too.
Yeah, thanks, guys. None of mine are as pyrotechnic or interesting as your first two, and I'm just giddy with how great yours were. So can I just resign?
Nope. You got to keep playing. Sorry, you're
lost. The gas station blows up. You're a poser. So.
Actually, you know what? I think Dingus. It's easier to think of stuff where the gas station blows up, because that's what they do. So I'm going to be very impressed. With any good ones that don't go the cheap and easy route of having the gas station blow up. So what do you got?
All right, well, the reason I thought of this was a gas station blowing up, but I went with something else. All right, my number three is a film that is dubbed as the Citizen Kane of alcoholic clown movies.
Kelly Wand is, yeah, he'll jump in and guess if you let him.
Wait. Oh, the one with Bobcat Goldthwait.
Yes,
right?
Very good. Shakes the Clown.
That's a good movie. Shakes the Clown's fine. That's a totally underrated film.
Yeah. No.
Real Men with John Ritter, another underrated film, and James Belushi. Everyone go rent that and then further.
So Dingus, tell us about the gas station scene in Shakes the Clown.
All right. Shakes the Clown, it opens with him at some woman's house and a boy peeing on his head. But that's the opening. So
Julie Brown. Right? The hot Julie Brown?
No.
Okay, sorry.
She's in it later, but it's Florence Henderson whose house he's at.
The hot Florence Henderson.
Exactly. But he's late for a clown gig and he's totally strung out and he stops by a gas station with the intent of using the restroom. But it's very stylized. He pulls up and the scene starts with him getting out of his little car, his little clown car. And it's an old fashioned gas station with really bright, beautiful, red and yellow colors, old fashioned gas pumps. And he goes in and he tells the guy, I need to use the can. And the guy, of course, says, hey, you can't use it unless you're a customer. And he pushes the guy back. And then he says one of these lines, and it's just so stupid. I feel embarrassed saying it, but it's one of my favorite lines. He just says, man, fucking people. And I just love that line.
I remember later the clown car blows up, and he goes, I just made my last payment. I love that movie. It's so dumb. It's such a great, stupid movie.
But I just love that. Fucking people.
Fucking people.
And then he goes into the bathroom of the restroom, and he puts on his clown makeup to the song Mannish Boy, but it's Muddy Waters' version of Mannish Boy. And he, you know, it's the, I'm a full grown man. And he puts on the makeup and he walks out and he gives this grin and the guys are out there at the gas pumps talking and he's just this amazing guy all of a sudden because he's in his clown makeup. And I
just
love
like
that.
Michael Cera.
Just like Michael Cera. I just love that. Fucking people.
Oh, you were worried about Shakes the Clown.
I love Shakes the Clown.
I love Shakes the Clown.
I like
Dingus.
Tom is going to pass on Shakes the Clown.
I don't hate Shakes the Clown. All right.
Hitchcock versus Goldthwait. Go.
Well, my number two is a movie that I don't like. I did not like this movie at all. I didn't think it was funny. I thought it was funny. I'm not a big fan of the lead actor. But it had one great gas station scene.
I know what it is.
Which I really liked. And it's the only thing I really remember from the movie. And it's the scene in Zoolander where they all drive up to get gas. And it's a play on, you know, the sexy chicks at the car wash or having a pillow fight. And the joke is that they're dumb male models. So they're filling up a Jeep and they just start playing with the hose, spraying gasoline on each other. And it's slow motion and they're taking their shirts off and frolicking in the gas. And I don't even remember. I think they drive away and it blows up, right? Like,
drive away. One of them lights a cigarette. And Zoolander sees him light it and goes, no, which kind of proves that Zoolander's smarter than they are. There's a characterization.
But I just remember that feeling that really inspired funny moment in that movie, which otherwise didn't work.
Yeah, and it's mixed well. It's to that really swishy music.
Do you remember the actual song used, Kelly Wand?
No. It's Brady Bunchy, right?
I don't remember. But I did remember liking the joke, so I quite enjoyed that. So that's my number two. Didn't care for the movie, but
loved it. Don't they get orange frappuccinos, and then it ends with a frappuccino cups coming at swooping at the screen into your face at the end, like when he blacks out?
Okay. Sure.
You don't even care about that.
I just care about the gas station scene. And I can't believe I even remembered it. I mean, the fact that I even remembered that bit of Zoolander speaks very highly of that particular scene. So, Kelly Wand, are you a Zoolander apologist?
I love that. I feel the same way you do. I think it's a crappy movie and a great scene in it. And I remember reading the script beforehand and just finding it incomprehensible, but the gas station scene was in it. And I go, oh, I hope this is a movie, if nothing else. And it was. And it's like, that lived up to expectations.
Right.
That is an awesome choice. There's no way I would ever have come up with that. That's awesome.
Well, that's another one I was worried you guys were going to scoop. Nobody's going to scoop my number one. I mean, I think I'm safe on my number one. But those two, I was worried about... you guys would scoop them.
You scooped me on that, actually. So I'm going to go with something else.
Did you really pick Zoolander?
I had it as an alternate.
Okay.
I love that sequence.
So for number two, did you have Zoolander and you're going to have to give us an alternate, or was that your number one?
That was my alternate.
Oh, okay. So what do you have instead?
My number two is a much lamer one, but a movie I adore. And I think I saw this movie like five times when it came out because I was an idiot and 9 years old. Capricorn 1.
Whoa, there's a gas station. Wait, yeah, do tell, Kelly Wand.
Is it doesn't Peter blow Hyams? Up. Wait, what?
Is that Peter Hyams?
Yes.
It's got to be, yeah.
So, okay, so tell, because I remember so many things about that movie. What was the gas station?
I do, too. The gas station scene is after O.J. Simpson and Sam Waterston's characters have both been...
Wait a minute, laughing. Sam Waterston is one of the astronauts?
Yeah, him and O.J.
Oh, yeah.
Who's James the third one?
James Brolin.
Yeah, I did remember that. That's right. Okay.
And Bosley from Charlie's Angels is Elliot Gould's boss. Remember Elliot Gould in that movie?
Wow, no, I don't. Is he the bad
guy? He's like the slouchy. No, he's like a reporter who figures it out and shows up as a deus ex machina at the end in the scene I'm talking about with a crop duster. You don't remember any of this? And the helicopter guys? Remember the bad guys were these faceless helicopters?
No, I remember those helicopters. The helicopters are what really struck me most as a kid. And, you know, I remember O.J. Simpson getting to the top of the mesa or the cliff.
No, it was Sam Waterston. He was doing that joke about his...
It's Sam Waterston that gets to the... How does O.J. Simpson die?
He dies first.
What? I just remember them going across the desert and just their faces all getting cracked up.
Yeah.
Well, they go in separate directions, and they shoot flares when they get caught, conveniently.
Oh yeah, I do remember.
They have their hands full of Cliff, and their hands are occupied.
But then it would cut to another astronaut, and he would see the flare in the distance and know that he was that much closer to his own demise. Oh, so explain the gas station scene to us.
Okay, so the other two guys are dead. James Brolin's the last astronaut.
By the way, so lay some groundwork here. This is that they faked the Mars landing, and the astronauts don't want to go along with it, so they have to hold them.
NASA's
prisoner.
In on it,
right?
NASA and the government are all evil because it was the late 70s and you could get away with awesome storylines like this. So the rocket blows up, which is
that's right.
Like that. So then they go, oh, well, we can't have the astronauts alive because the rocket's gone. And so we have to kill our astronauts to make this and then just say they died nobly. So the astronauts escape and they go on foot in this. I forget how they get in the desert offhand.
Well, I remember this part. So they're being held in a like a holding room, and they do the trick where you take the hinges off the door, and they escape, and it's this like desert installation. So here's the part too. I remember they're astronauts. They're smart enough to know that stuff.
Right.
So they escape. They're in a desert installation, and they rush out, and there's a Learjet parked out there. And another thing astronauts know, Kelly Wand, is
fly anything.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I remember
there's a Learjet fueled up and ready to go at this secret installation.
But here's one thing I remember. If I'm not mistaken, they get in the Learjet and there's a stunt sequence where a car is trying to run the Learjet down while it's going to take off, and it barely clears the car.
Yeah.
And does it knock the landing gear off the Learjet and they have to crash land in the desert?
I don't remember that.
Anyway.
That sounds better than probably what's actually in
the movie. I just remember the stunt with them hijacking the Learjet and barely clearing a car to take off. I mean, I'm sure it was like done with camera perspective, but, you know, my 9-year-old mind, I was like, whoa.
Oh,
yeah.
My 9-year-old mind exploded when I saw it. I was fetishizing on it.
Okay. So, and the helicopters too, because the helicopters are like dragonflies. And there was even this really, like nowadays it would be so stupid. Like the helicopters at one point are hovering side by side, like they're looking at something, and they pivot in towards each other, like they're talking to each other.
Oh, wait, now I remember. O.J. Simpson is hallucinating that it's vultures over his head, and then they turn it.
That's right, and they come down, and it's the helicopters, yeah.
And there's also a scene where Elliot Gould is at a bar with a whistleblower from NASA, and he goes to get a drink for 5 seconds or something. He comes back, and the guy's gone, and that's how, like, they got him at the bar or something.
In 5 seconds.
And then they plant drugs in Elliot Gould's apartment. Oh, I love that movie so much.
Okay, well, so explain the gas station scene to us.
Okay,
well,
so...
Wait, first of all, I can't wait for the movie that you guys put out called My 9-Year-Old Mind.
Did you see that movie, Dignus, when you were a little... Well, you're younger than us, I think.
Oh, yeah, I saw it. And in fact, I gave it as a gift at one of our Shoot Club White Elephant parties.
I read the novelization multiple times.
Wow.
That's how gay I was for Capricorn. I was obsessed with Capricorn 1.
I love that movie, yeah.
Okay, right. So James Brolin's the only astronaut left. He knows both of his friends are dead. He's the only one who knows the truth, and he's in a gas station. And somehow the helicopters can see he's in the gas station through the window from miles away. So they park, and they come in, and he jumps through a window, and helicopters, I don't know. I guess it's not really a good gas station. That's my number two. Go.
But it's at a gas station, and it's a great movie. So go. Oh, you know what? I don't even know if it's a great movie.
Parks the crop duster right then and gestures, and then he has to run to the crop duster, get on it. Helicopter pilots chase after him, and then they use their crop dust helicopters crash into the cliff because they all.
This movie's ingenious.
I know.
Forget
is it
the
right
birds.
Now?
Yeah, forget the birds. Wow, good. That's a good call, Kelly Wand.
Yeah.
All right, Dingus, another tough act for you to follow. What do you got now?
First of all, next week's 3x3 best crop dusters.
Independence Day.
North by Northwest.
Silver Streak. Right.
I'm tapped out. All right, what am I at, number two?
Number two, what do you got for us?
All right, I'm going to give you a quote. How do you like that?
Give us a quote.
I will bite my thumb at them, which is a disgrace to them if they bear it.
Baz Luhrmann's, well, Romeo and Juliet, right.
Romeo plus Juliet, yes.
You have to say the plus? Okay. And is it just the opening fight scene is set in a gas station?
Oh, it's beautiful. Yeah, it's perfectly set in a gas station. Do you not remember that?
I have not seen that in, probably since it was in theaters. No, I don't.
Did you see Romeo and Juliet, Kelly?
Chunks of it. Felt like a musical. Well, I read the book. I don't need to see the movie.
the novelization of the
boss. Kind of sad.
Yeah. Well, describe it for us, Sting. It's the opening fight scene, and lay it out for us. What do they do with the gas station?
Yeah, it's the one with DiCaprio and Dash Mihawk, which I was going to open this by saying Dash Mihawk is in this opening scene. And it's gorgeous. It's the colors, and I love the way this scene is set. Is it the Montague boys? I think Dash Mihawk is Jamie Kennedy are with the Montagues.
Jamie Kennedy?
Yeah, what? And he's the one who says that line.
Wow.
I don't think they're very good, but I love the style of the scene. They drive up to a gas station, and it's called Phoenix Gas, and the colors are just
vibrant.
They're not just they're colorful to coin Tom's phrase. they burn your eyes. It's just so beautiful. And then the Montagues drive in behind, and it's over the top and beautiful. And the sound, you just have to listen to the sound. If you can get a good, anybody can get a good copy of the film if they have a DVD player. The sound is freaking phenomenal. And the way John Leguizamo comes out and says, peace, peace. I don't think he's ever said one word twice better. Or I don't think he's ever said a line better. He was just amazing. The sound design is amazing. The colors are amazing. And I love it. And there is that beautiful sort of iconic moment of the match falling at a gas station.
Oh, yeah.
And that's what a different movie inspired me to ask for this list. But this movie, when I was thinking through different movies and, you know, all week long, I sort of run through a catalog of films in my head. I get an early workable list at the beginning of the week, and then I just run through lists sort of in the background of my head. And when this one popped up and I remembered the gas station scene, I really liked this film. And at first I don't think I did, because I was not very happy with how Shakespeare sounded in the mouths of a lot of these actors. But the style of this film and the setting and the world this film is really, really wins me over in the end. And this scene is gorgeous and over the top and weird. And I love the way it sets the scene for the rest of the film to come.
Good one. That's a very good one, Dingus.
I guess I have to see the beginning.
Yeah, all you have to do is watch the first 15 minutes of it, and you'll get what I'm saying. It's just so vibrant. It's just so alive.
Real quick, what's the name of the guy that played Tybalt?
Wait a minute.
Google
you mean
it.
John Leguizamo? Don't say that to me. John Leguizamo. How about that? John Leguizamo.
Okay. I did say it weird. I thought that.
John Leguizamo. John Leguizamo.
John Leguizamo.
How do you want
You're
to
racist.
Say
racist? Racist.
No, you said it right. Did you? That second time, at first, you called him John Leguizamo. Which was, okay.
Well, I apologize to John Leguizamo.
If he's listening, we meant no offense.
Of the Coney Island Leguizamos.
Good. That's a good one. All right. Are we on to our number ones?
We're at number one.
My number one, the gas station does not blow up, actually. And as a matter of fact, part of what makes gas stations good in movies, partly, is that they are incredibly mundane. Everybody knows the experience of a gas station. Gas station is nothing special. It's so everyday. It's something that's an everyday part of life. And this movie plays on that. This is an existential horror movie based on the common experience of being at a crowded gas station. It's technically a sort of a rest stop by the side of a freeway, and getting separated from the person that you came there with. It's a Dutch movie called The Vanishing. And it opens with a couple on a road trip, and they pull up it's a big old gas station by the side of the freeway, and they get separated. She goes in to get a Coke or whatever, and he's pumping gas in the car, and he never sees her again. And that's the premise of the movie, and the movie unfolds what actually happened, and it all starts with this gas station with this mundane visit, and it ramps up as she's not coming back, and he can't find her, and he goes in to look for her, and he waits for her, and he goes to talk to the owner about what happened, and he calls the police, and it lays all this groundwork at this gas station for this really cool Dutch existential horror movie. Don't watch the American remake.
With
Kiefer Sutherland, and is it Sandra Bullock, maybe?
Yeah, it's wow. Introduced us to Sandra
And Jeff
Bullock.
Bridges, that's right.
Jeff Bridges.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the odd thing about the Vanishing
the
remake,
too.
Oh, they butchered the ending. But the odd thing about the Vanishing remake is the same director. They got the Dutch guy who did the original movie
to ruin his own movie.
Yeah, exactly. So that's my number one gas station scene.
A great pick and a great film.
Yep. Yep.
It really is. And unfortunately for me, all I could remember was the American version of it. And I couldn't remember if the Dutch version had a gas station or if that was an American convention.
No.
And I just couldn't go back and find the other one.
Well, it's definitely it's a weird European gas station. I mean, it has a different vibe to it, but it's definitely a gas station. And that's the thing. There are we'll get into this after people. I don't want to trump anybody else's list.
Can I just ask you? Sure. Have you seen the Dutch one lately? I haven't seen it since I saw it in a theater.
I don't think I ever saw it in a theater. I think I rented it. But I don't know. I've seen it in the last 10 years or so.
Do you remember? Does the Dutch killer rehearse? I mean, does he?
Yes, and you're now spoiler. Actually, I'm teasing. I mean, that's the date for us for spoilers for Vanishing is long since passed. But yes, there's definitely the scene where he's rehearsing.
Well, I'm just wondering. Okay, that's fine. That's what I was wondering as I thought about this film.
It's almost shot for shot remake. I mean, it's like Gus Van Sant doing Psycho or something, except for these really weird choices about the ending and even the final scene. The final scene after everything's over. Is a joke. Like, it's almost like the end of episodic TV, like some cop drama or something, where they end with a laugh and a freeze frame. I mean, it's that kind of thing. It's just terrible.
The American one or the?
Yeah, the American one. Yeah. Kiefer Sutherland and his new girlfriend, this won't give anything away, they're at a diner, and, you know, he's come through all this terrible stuff and he's got a new girlfriend, he's at a diner, and a waiter comes up and is going to serve him coffee. And if you've seen the movie, you know that accepting coffee plays a big part in the movie. And a waiter comes up and serves him coffee, and he covers his cup and he says, "No thanks, I don't drink coffee." And then they laugh.
And then the credits. So they know what happened to him, and they just drug him with some other beverage.
Spoiler, but yeah. What do you mean?
I don't know.
What?
Well, why do they laugh? I don't understand.
Well, because he. Well, they're very.
Never mind.
Yeah.
Let's not legitimize that remake by talking.
The American remake has a very different ending than the
yes.
Dutch original.
I remember the good ending of the Dutch one.
Yeah, and so that doesn't none of that happens in the American remake. The American movie is a very traditional. Yeah. The hero survives. He gets the girl, and they share a joke about not drinking coffee and credits. Scene.
That movie really taps into our fears of gas stations.
Well, what's your number one, Kelly Wand? What's your number one?
My number one is a movie I know you guys haven't seen because it came out before 2008. It's a little film called It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. Ever saw that?
That's like with Jonathan Winters, right?
Yes. Hey, see? Yeah, it's Jonathan Winters and these two like weird bespectacled brothers totally destroying this gas station where they have a fight for no reason, basically. And the reason I love the scene is because it's from back in the day where when you had a set piece where a gas station gets trashed, you had to trash an actual gas station. You could CG it.
Ah.
Like Zoolander.
By the way, someone's bomb is about to detonate.
No. It's the phone I took the ringer off so it wouldn't intrude on our podcast.
It's about to go off. Don't put it near a gas station.
At the rate of our listeners' attention spans.
The green wire, Kelly. It's the green wire.
So Jonathan Winters and two weird bespectacled brothers trash a gas station. Does it actually blow up?
No, it just gets destroyed with tires going everywhere, and the roof comes down comically and doesn't kill anyone.
Now, is that one of those like wacky race?
Yeah, it's an ensemble movie where they're all trying to get to the money.
Okay, right. Do you think it holds up? Would it be just in? Would it just be?
No, but you can't hate it. And I like that scene because it just goes on forever. It's one of those scenes where it's sort of about rhythms and repetitive. Like it just kind of keeps expanding on itself.
Okay, that's good because Dingus and I would have never picked that sort of thing. So you're here to represent
those. Anything from the 60s was safe.
Like the birds.
I think Jonathan Winters is a little overrated. Like, I don't know what Jonathan Winters, besides Mork and Mindy, like, what was his greatest role? Through? Oh, Jonathan Winters, that guy's a genius.
He was in The Poseidon Adventure, wasn't he?
Was he?
Yeah.
And that's his claim to fame?
I think Dingus is probably pulling your leg. I doubt he was even in The Poseidon Adventure.
There might have been Shelley Winters, I'm sorry.
Oh, that was me. Well, they were related.
Oh.
No, they weren't. Sad.
I know. Actually, I didn't know one way or the other.
Let's just say a bunch of random nonsense.
How's that different?
And people listen normally to it. And then we get bad ratings go, you know, people.
Yeah, I have bad news. We're losing our 10 o'clock time slot. We're being moved an hour later. We're replacing Conan. So sorry.
He's gonna be great on this podcast.
Dingus, what is your favorite scene set in a gas station?
This was an 11th hour replacement.
Oh, because someone scooped you on the birds?
No, because the crappy one I had, this is my, what I would dub my, I'm not going to even say that. This is something I thought you guys would pick or you would think was too obvious, but I went back and rewatched the scene and I watched the scene several times.
Give us a line.
I love the scene.
Okay, give us a line.
I don't have some way to put it. That's the way it is.
Raising Arizona.
No.
The Hitcher?
No.
Oh, it's, I know, No Country.
Yeah. That's
No Country. God! Do-overs. I call do-overs. I'm going to call executive privilege. My
it
number
was
one.
Was Desert and Cohen, so I was on the right track.
My number one is
I can't believe you guessed another Cohen Brothers film, Kelly.
Wow.
I was
going to
put that, but I go, well, he doesn't get gas in there, so.
Yes, he does. Totally.
Well,
does.
We don't see him pump it, so it
what does he think he's paying for? He didn't just come in for the corn nuts.
But and the guy says, and for the gas. And it starts with a shot of the Texaco sign, and then it goes into the station.
But I thought the rule was you couldn't pick a convenience store.
It's a gas station, Kelly Wand. He's getting
you
gas.
Have a convenience store attached to it.
What gas station doesn't have a convenience store attached to it, first of all?
My point was you couldn't just pick a convenience store, so I was trying to avoid some of the scenes in Raising Arizona where he's just getting jugs in a convenience store. So it's not just a convenience store.
What does this have to do with Raquel Welch?
1, 2, 3.
Wow, that's a great pick, Dingus. That's just, wow, I cannot believe you stealthed that one past us.
Sorry about that. I watched this scene over and over and over again, and just as an actor who's had to go through scenes and try to pick something to do in an acting class and has looked at scenes and looked at scenes and looked at scenes, this scene is perfect. It is a perfect scene. If you watch it over and over again, it is perfect.
Yes.
To say nothing of the fact that it cemented why this film worked so well that year for this particular set of directors for me. Because for me, this is the scene where they often would make a misstep, where they would choose a goofy character to play the guy who was the gas station proprietor. And instead they chose the perfect guy. And he's not somebody I know from anything else. He's this guy named Gene Jones, and he's perfect.
And he has so much dignity in that scene too.
Yeah.
I mean, they don't make fun of him at all. I mean, I'm sorry to cut you off, Dingus, but that's part of how perfect he is. He's such a real person.
That's absolutely right. And you get a perfect sense of
something.
Yeah, that's right. And something you said earlier, Tom, about this idea of a gas station being a place that could explode at any moment.
Nice.
It didn't really occur to me other than and then when you said that, it made me think of what's going on emotionally in this scene. And also, as I watched it again, the scene is a perfect setup, and I'm not going to give anything away as a spoiler, but it's a perfect setup for what it's supposed to set up later in the film. And a lesser director would have used this coin flipping scene to be pyrotechnic and wreak carnage and then set up something later on. And this just sets up menace. It sets up the possibility or the potential. And he is perfect. And there's so many beautiful things going on in this scene. And something I noticed is this, the sound in the scene of the uncrumpling of this wrapper on the counter.
Yep.
Arguably the best scene ever written.
Okay.
Name a better written scene.
The control tower sequence in Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Too fruity.
Watch when you watch the scene again, watch Sugar as he's leaving the station and he says, and becoming just a coin, and he gives this look.
Which it is.
This look of a mother, and then exactly what you just said, Kelly, which it is. Look, watch this look. I love that scene, and I can't believe nobody else picked it, and I'm just
pissed
that I got it. I didn't consider it a gas station scene for some reason.
Well, it obviously is.
It's so large in my head that, I don't know.
Well, it's like Dingus says, you know, there's a Texaco sign, and even paying for gas. I mean, that's why he's there, and yeah, it obviously, yeah. That's Kelly Wand, you and I have failed. We have failed.
I thought of it too, so I failed even more miserably.
Yeah. I don't know. I have an excuse. I didn't even think of it. Yeah.
That's not a gas station scene. It's a great scene, but you don't see the gas, so it doesn't count.
Also, one other thing, I've seen this film in its entirety two or three times, and I missed why he gets Sugar's attention so that the whole scene plays out.
Because he looks at his license plate and notices where he's from. Yeah. Isn't that right?
He just asks him, so he asks him something about the weather up there. And Sugar says, why? He goes, oh, I see you're from Dallas. And then you see this thing on his face. And I didn't notice that the first couple of times I watched the film.
So did you look up Gene Jones? Like, is he really not like a character actor with a long list of credits?
I looked him up. I didn't see a list. I was expecting a list, maybe a couple of TV things, but I'm not going to look now because it would ruin the recording.
Oh, that's a great pick.
That ship's already sailed. But is he a real Texan?
I have no idea. I apologize. I don't have that information in my fingers.
You're not a real fan of him, are you?
Clearly not.
All right, good. Well, that was a great list. There was some good stuff there. It was a good call, Dingus.
All of you, good job.
I don't like mine now. I don't like my 3x3 for next week.
No, the birds is good.
No. I like mine for Dingus's list. I'm picking the 3x3 for next week, and I'm going to have to bunt.
Do not bunt.
Or punt. Or whatever that is. I'm going to have to foul.
You're going to have to pitch hint.
Yeah.
Pitch hit.
Here's what I want from you guys next week. So I rewatched A Serious Man, and I don't want to, this partly is inspired by that. I don't want to tip my hand too much because it's a spoiler, but one of the things that happens in A Serious Man has to do with weather. And what I want, and I thought also of the terrible Benjamin Button movie where, you have throughout interlaced these stories of, Cate Blanchett is really old in a nursing home in New Orleans and Hurricane Katrina is blowing in. And that's for no good reason. And there's supposed to be some tension introduced there as she's unrolling this story for her daughter, and we see the story, and then it cuts back to her, and Hurricane Katrina is closer. And so that to me is a crappy use of weather in a movie. Whereas what happens in A Serious Man is an incredible use of weather in a movie. You know, weather so often just scenery, or, you know, you have the hero in the rain because he looks better when he's wet or whatever. So what I want from you are three movies that make good use of weather. So
that's good. Yeah.
Okay, good. Right. So
that's very broad.
It is broad, and weather can be many things. It can be rain. It can be wind. It can be lightning. So do with it as you will. But like I said, it can't just be scenery, and that's usually what weather is. So, there you go. Do with that as you will, and we'll be back here next week. We will be seeing Book of Eli. See it and join us. I am Tom Chick. I'm here with Christian Malinsky.
Christian Morosky.
I was close. And Kelly Wand.
Poor man's Ben Lyons.
Who is Ben Lyons?
He called I Am Legend the greatest film ever made. We'll be right back.
Isn't that Jeffrey Lyons?